Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Marcus Hippia, and Daniel Bage.
On today's show, we'll be meeting visual artist Marinella Senatore, the Italian creator who brings together both people and places to make her works. She'll be discussing her upcoming project, soon to fill the streets of London.
We'll also be hearing from revered actor Jim Broadbent, the Oscar winner from hits such as Iris, Harry Potter, Bridget Jones and Game of Thrones. We'll be discussing the new graphic novel he's co-authored, Dull Margaret, later in the show.
And we'll be welcoming back the legendary Japanese composer Ryuichi Sakamoto to the show. He's returning to the weekly along with filmmaker Stephen Namuro Shibble to discuss their new documentary about the musician's life, Coda.
That is all to come, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be talking about next week's news and we'll play some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Marcus, another busy week here at Midori House as ever. What's been happening with you? We've been sort of crossing paths, both working to set up the daily. You've been in studio, so we've been ships in the night, as it were, but you seem to be busy as ever.
I think it's quite ironic that we literally face each other. We are sitting around the same table and still we are. We've been so busy this week that we barely had time to talk at all. I've been obviously getting ready for our Quality of Life conference that takes place in Zurich next week. But now, shall we take a look at what else is happening next week? Shall we invite Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco in? There was something in the air that night, the stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando. So, Fernando, welcome to the program. You've been busy as ever, checking out all the goings on for this coming week, what we should be paying attention to.
Absolutely. It's going to be a busy week indeed. We have a very important election as my first story.
Is that the Turkish election?
Yes, they're voting today. And things can change quite dramatically in the country. So basically, Erdogan, he won a referendum, I believe, last year, where, you know, the role of the prime minister would be scrapped. So basically, Turkey will become a country more like France or the US, where the president has the power. But for this to happen, you know, new elections are needed. And Erdogan, from what I can see, he's still the favorite to win the election. But, you know, it's not going to be so easy for him because even though, you know, he dominates all the airwaves, you know, there are a lot of opposition candidates. And you know, one commentator said, Turkey is not Russia. So, you know, there's a lot of people on social media. So I think the election probably go for a runoff between Erdogan and one of the other candidates. So it would be very interesting to see. I mean, because if Erdogan loses that, I mean, you know, it would be very surprising as well.
Fernando, this almost seems like a referendum on Erdogan himself, I guess. There's been a lot of unity with the opposition parties, and there's always the risk, I guess, of vote splitting there if there's different strong voices. Is there a candidate that stands out, do you think?
There is one. He's a center-left candidate, Muharrem İnce, and he's very charismatic. And I think, you know, to win an election against, you know, a strong man like Erdogan, you need someone with some sort of charisma.
What else is happening next week?
Well, guys, do you guys like compilations, album compilations?
Used to love them as a kid, and I used to make the mixtapes as well. But there used to be one way, you know, you like one song on it, but you're not sure about the whole album for an artist, so you buy it in the compilation because it's got other good tracks. Love them.
Well, the reason why I'm discussing, because, you know, Now compilation, Now that's what I call music here in the UK. They're about to release very soon, you know, their 100th edition. So the reason why I chose the story, they just released Now this week, the Now, that's what I call Summer 2018, which I already bought and I think it's fantastic compilation. But they have such an amazing history behind and it's a very important year for them. So they're relaunching their first album that was released in 1983 with bands like Duran Duran, Culture Club, and the 100th one, and they sold more than 120 million copies. It's a you know, astounding number. And apparently every British house has at least four of them on average. It's something that I would think would never lose the appeal. I know Spotify playlists are popular as well, but I think some people still not go and buy their album as well. I have to buy that one.
All right. Thank you very much, Fernando. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from visual artist Marinella Senatore.
Marinella Senatore is a visual artist from Italy whose events bring people together, sometimes up to 20,000 of them, to create movement in public spaces.
She'll be looking to fill the streets of London on the 7th of July, or some of them at least, for Art Night, the nocturnal art spectacle brought to the city by a different curatorial team each year. And this year, the program is curated by South Bank's Hayward Gallery. The London procession will begin at the Battersea Power Station and then head north, ending at the Hayward, possibly around 2 a.m.
Marinella joins us on the line from Austria now to tell us more. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Marinella. So, first of all, I'm curious about your journey into this kind of work. It's very unconventional. How did these gatherings begin?
Well, my background is very multifaceted because I am a professional violinist. So I study classical music for a long time, and I also study cinema at the National Film School in Rome. Well, I started playing in the orchestras and then working on the movie films, and I realized that what I really like is not to be alone in my studio, but engage the talents of other people and create something like a choir, you know? So the choral structure of work is really part of my background and part of my biggest desire. So I realized that I could also engage people not connected with the system of culture or art particularly. And there are a lot of people that have a lot of skills that they really want to share with others or achieve new ones. And they want to teach or learn from others. And because one of the social issues that worry me more than others, it's the coexistence among humans. I think that this kind of project can foster this kind of communication among people that at the end don't know each other.
Could you tell us something about your previous project? What have been your favorites, or, for example, what has been the biggest project so far?
Oh, well, one that involved the 20,000 people in three countries, UK, and the city where I worked was Derby, not so far from London, Berlin in Germany, and Madrid in Spain. It was in 2012, and actually it wasn't a performance, but it was an opera for the screen. So people were engaged from the first step of the creation, from the writing of an original libretto, an original story, plot, and then creating costume, being a production designer, or whatever they wished it to be, because this kind of project also addressed the wishes of the people. And another very, very big project I did this year with over 5 million of people, working with 8,000 schools in Italy from south to north, including Ireland. So we had at the end 2 million of children and plus with their family over 5 million of Italians. And very, very recently, just a few days ago, last Saturday, we have a big, big procession within the framework of the Biennial Manifesta Edition 12, which was held in Palermo, and was a very, very big success. The number of the people were incredible, but especially the energy was incredible. Really unbelievable how the city, all the city, performed and how the audience included themselves in a very free, very visceral and sometimes very passionate way.
I wonder, how do you control crowds that big? Does anything go wrong ever?
Of course. Of course. And we embrace this because the street is not easy. Making a theater or whatever other action on the street, especially in our performance, we mix a lot of different artistic languages as acting, slam poetry, dance, a lot of different style of dance, and a lot of different style of music. So you have choirs, you have soloists, you have opera singers, you have even synchronized swimmers that perform without water, we have activists, so we have also spoken words, and we have all sorts of ages, from very, very young children to very, very old people. So of course there are a lot of moments of confusion and chaos, but at the end there is a very strong dramaturgy behind that we create together with people, so everything is extremely under control, but there is also an open space for things to happen, and we are not scared if something is not exactly accorded with our plans. Actually, we embrace this spontaneity and this improvisation. It's very important for people to feel there is a freedom for them as well.
Can you give me examples of what's gone wrong?
Oh, for instance, that huge band, brass band of 60 members goes in another plaza instead of the square accorded. Or, for instance, in this Palermo procession, the leaders of at the first line of the procession were blind people. So, of course, it's a big risk because they can take another street and you have to change completely the route. But this is fantastic because it opens new possibility. But never it's about the passion of the or the enthusiasm that people also from the audience give to us. And actually, when people from the audience break the scheme and they want to be part of that, this is something that is not under our control, because we control our participants and we rehearse with them and we know exactly what we are going to do. But when people from the audience jump in this, of course, this is unpredictable, but it's also fantastic. So at the end, these risks are extremely fruitful and exciting for us.
And looking ahead to the London procession, do you have any idea how many people will join, and will you be appealing for more people to join?
Oh my gosh, I feel that there will be thousands of participants and for sure thousands of audience members. And sometimes the line is very blurred because the audience want at a certain point to become also participants. So at the very end, I won't be able until we finish to tell you the exact number. But at the moment we have contacted thousands of associations and groups, and we are creating a different station and almost 5 stations along the path that you highlighted at the beginning of this conversation. So we really wait for at least 1,000 participants and I don't know how many thousand of audience members.
And what is the statement of the London procession, no matter how many people show up? Is it all just about having fun, or is there sort of a theme behind it?
No, it's the enjoyment in the art. I think it's a very important quality. And it's not something to underestimate. But there are, of course, a lot of concepts that we agree on. Emancipation, empowerment of people, sharing of skill, thinking about coexistence, producing a way to coexist. One of the most important social issues, in my opinion, is to stay together at this moment and learn and find out how to stay together. This is very political and social topic that we address every time that we put people together. Even just the act of gathering people together is a very social and political act. And taking the street and the appropriation in a very peaceful way, by the way, of course, of the street, these are all very strong elements. And because we have also activists and people that are involved in the social structures and work for the same topics, this is very important. And the sharing of skills and also the fact that we gift people and audience with all the talents that we can find, it's something very important for the emancipation of the participant first, but also for the empowerment of the audience, because the audience are very active in this kind of processes.
And are the audiences different in different cities? Do you think the mood is different from city to city, town to town?
Totally, because these projects are extremely site-specific. So we work with local people. I don't bring a profession from other countries. So I try to map the city. And for London, it's not easy like in other places, which are smaller, of course. But in any case, the big part of our work, the team also of the Art Night, and my big skill is that we are able to contact as much people as possible, to communicate what we want to do, to address their desire. And of course, this must be, and it will be, totally different from something we did in Palermo or in Ecuador or in China or in the 23 countries that already we worked. Of course, otherwise it will be not transparent, not real. It will be something that is pre-existent and just a fulfilling of the desire of the artist. And for me, in my point of view, it's very, very strong. I believe in art and especially in public art, only and exclusively when the people are part of the creative process. They are not employees, they are participants.
Marinella, I can't help myself asking, do you have favorite audiences, or do you find places where you think the people are not that easy to handle?
I don't have a favorite audience, I like people, but I can tell you that in our, because I like to talk in this way, in plural, not in as an individual, in our performances or our projects in general, I like to involve a lot people that are not connected with art, people that maybe don't know neither where is the Tate, or maybe they never enter into a museum. These people are part of the society, and these people can be a new public for culture expression, and they have a lot to say and a lot to give to the other with a lot of generosity. So if I have to tell you what I like very much this kind of people that can be emancipated just for a while or create a contemporary, a short community or a big community, even a temporary community together with other people. So I like this sharing, this melting pot of different situations, these languages and this dissonance among languages. And I don't address this project only to the expert of art field, not at all. Actually, just the opposite. So the amateur are my favorite, if I have to tell.
So you're looking to fill the streets of London on the 7th of July, but do you have any plans for after that? What's happening after London?
Oh my gosh, a lot of things. I have to say that we work constantly. Even at the same time that I will be in London, my team of assistant and choreographer will be in Germany for another project with the School of Narrative Dance, which is this dramatic school I founded in 2013, open, free of charge, and that instigate people to be confident and move their body in a narrative way. Actually, the body keeps all the memories and the story that each individual has. So it's a very powerful element, a powerful tool for communication and storytelling. Just after that, I will be in Austria with another performance and another exhibition in a Kunsthalle in Bregenz. And a few days after, I will come back to Sicily, where I will work with protest songs and protest music, specifically with a group called Zazzi, which are very, very famous, actually, to have been former workers of Fiat in Italy. And they create a group, and they tried to share their ideas and fight for their right to music. And then in Berlin, a solo show, 7th of September, and then afterwards, again, Austria and again, US. That's actually, there are already two exhibitions going in Richmond, Virginia, and New York by me. So a lot of things. We never stop.
Marinella, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to seeing the outcome of the event. And Marinella Senatore's London procession is part of Art Night, taking place across London on the 7th of July. You can head to 2018.artnight.london to get involved. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Oscar-winning British actor Jim Broadbent has made roles his own in films such as The Weeknd, Brooklyn, the Harry Potter series, and Game of Thrones.
But his latest project is a book, the graphic novel Dull Margaret, created with artist and cartoonist Dix, that is D-I-X. It depicts a tale that, among other influences, is based on the work of 16th century Dutch painter Peter Bruegel.
Monocle's Augustin Macellari met Jim recently to learn more. He began by asking about the origins of the book's creation.
It was quite a while back, so I'm not entirely sure. I think it came sort of from a number of different things at the same time, really. I come from Lincolnshire, and we had a place very near the coast at the time, and I spent a lot of time on the Lincolnshire coast, and it's very flat, and parts of it are very marshy and wet and muddy. That always intrigued me, and it was always empty. There were very few people there. And I also started getting into the whole idea of fairy stories, and I started thinking of wanting to write a film script. And the idea of writing a film script always comes from writing a good part for myself, really. And I had the idea of this sort of lonely woman living out on the marshes, lives by catching eels. So I started researching eel catching and and her and her being lonely. And then, and I quite fancied the idea of playing her because she was obviously going to be a rather plain woman. So it all came up together, really, in the fairy stories. And then I thought, well, she could have witchy skills and spells and incantations and sort of witchy salves and ointments and she could put together. So that all combined together, really. And so I wrote this film script, which is basically a one-woman show.
I did wonder about that, because there's very little dialogue. Mm. So it's more, I mean, I suppose it's all stage direction.
Well, it is. It's all. It's nearly all stage direction, isn't it? So, which is ideal for sending it to an artist when I want to make it into a graphic novel, because it's all description and, as you say, very little dialogue, which is probably, from Dix's point of view, he's the artist, was a blessing. Because he hasn't got to have huge speech bubbles.
That's it, more room for him to kind of flex his pen. I'd like to ask a bit more about Dix in a sec, but I also read that the kind of figure of Margaret herself was in part inspired by a Bruegel painting.
There's certainly the name, Dull Margaret, and it comes from De la Grete, the Bruegel painting of De la Grete at the gates of hell. It's this strong, very sort of striking, ugly, funny woman, heavily clad in sort of a mishmash of clothes and bearing odd weapons and marching across the gates of hell. And it's a very striking image, and I just liked that strength in her. And there's a humour in her as well, somehow.
I completely agree. I looked at it, and she looks incredibly purposeful. Mm. She's kind of, as you say, tooled up, ready to take on the hordes. Margaret, in your book, there's a lot more pathos to her.
Yeah, I think there's... I love the name, De la Grete, and then that translates as Mad Meg. But I like the dull bit of her from my perspective. I like her being dull and rather plain and in the plain and very bland marsh world that she lives in. It all sort of fitted in. But so it's not really drawn from the painting too much, but there's a spirit of Margaret that I drew from Grete, I suppose.
I'm interested by your sort of relationship with the Lincolnshire coast. The coast on the north of England, I've read some really great literature that kind of ruminates on them in this very folkloric way. I don't know if you've read The Loney, which came out a couple of years ago.
No, I don't know that. No.
I'm from the east, so I know about the fens rather than... Yeah. Which is also a place where people catch eels, actually. Mm. So The Loney is set on this stretch of land and also centres around this kind of very arcane, almost atavistic ritual that's never really brought into the foreground quite in the way that Dull Margaret's is. How connected are you to folklore and how familiar are you with kind of witchy traditions and practices?
Well, no, I read a lot. I've got lots of books and histories and different, you know, and the witch hunts and in Europe and also I took a lot from sort of Bruegel etchings and various medieval depictions of witches. But I wasn't familiar with the world at all before, but in researching I went into a lot of it and found out quite a lot.
What's amazing about Margaret is that she seems less like someone who is actively a witch and more like someone who has this knowledge and is driven to use it by the kind of cruelty of her circumstances.
Yes, it's not her primary purpose being a witch, but she went in when she was, you know, driven to the depths of despair. She somehow remembered when the hanged man floats into her world that triggers a memory that she has those skills,
sort of ancestral almost.
Yeah,
is it? There are moments of humour which, again, well, I read that your interest in working with Dix stemmed from a kind of shared dark humour, gallows humour. But Margaret is kind of presented as caught between these appalling feelings, which are profound loneliness and deep greed. And I suppose I wanted to ask whether you feel that one is a product of the other, which came first, and also just how you empathised with her when you were writing the script.
I adored her, really. I totally empathised with her. I mean, it's not so much greed as poverty. I mean, it's loneliness and poverty. Those are the two things. And she's, at the beginning, she's just about getting by, and then it all collapses, and she's robbed and abused, and that's when it all comes to the fore. Now, I don't see her as greedy, I think, and just sort of... But she's quite childlike when the old man comes into her life, and she's a bully, but in a childish way, in the way that a child can bully a puppy because they can. She's got someone she can abuse and control. Mm. But it's not really her way, as it transpires. That isn't a relationship that sustains its nature.
And I suppose now you say that she's childlike, that does kind of come to the fore in those scenes where she's sort of playing with her gold and kind of interacting with it, and she puts it on her eyes. And happy little girl. So, Dix was an artist that you first encountered in The Guardian, is that right?
Yeah.
And when you were writing the script, you said it was initially meant as a screenplay. Did you realise that it would become a graphic novel?
I knew from early on when I was writing it that it could become a graphic novel. It was written as a film script, and it still is a film script. There is a film script there. I've always loved various cartoonists and illustrators. And Dix, his comic strip in The Guardian, I think Steve Bell was away, and he stood in for a few months writing this one about a sort of eccentric circus called Roll Up, Roll Up. And it struck me immediately. I thought, I absolutely love the drawings. I love the subject. I love his wit and subversive wit. And so I sort of logged that and actually consciously thought if he would be brilliant to approach if I ever wanted to go for a graphic novel if no one will make it into a film, which is basically what happened. And by the time I had decided that, I was able to Google him and find out and introduce myself.
And how collaborative was the process of then making it? Was it simply a matter of sending him the script and then...
I sent him the script and introduced myself and said, would he be interested? Immediately we got going on it, really. And then started sending... because he lives in Hay-on-Wye. And so I had a total email communication relationship, and he'd send images to start with, I think, Margaret to start with, and different options for Margaret, and all of which were beautiful drawings, beautiful characters. But, one was too fat, and one was too vulnerable, and one was too neurotic, and we settled on one. I didn't, in the end... want it to be like me at all. I think I'd moved on from that anyway, even in film terms. So we found this wonderful character together, really, and I'd sent him some images of the marshes as I saw them. But I think I had written it all in the script. My descriptions must have been good because everything he drew was very accurate to what I had imagined.
I think it must be really gratifying, the process of writing a graphic novel, because it seems as though working with an artist, maybe that you can realise with more clarity almost your vision if you have a good relationship with them. Do you read comics?
I read a lot of comics, but I'm not a great graphic novel aficionado. I obviously have read a number, but it's not a sort of preoccupation.
Obviously, you kind of had it in mind that it was to be a film script. One of my questions that I've written down, which is kind of negated by that now, is to ask about the difference between writing a script that is meant to be read and one that's meant to be heard. And I wonder if you did have to tinker with it in any way when you came to...
Not really, no. Hardly at all. I was kept waiting for Dix to say, can we lose this scene or extend this scene or... change something and rewrite. There was none of that, really. I don't know if he's right, but he accepted it as it was, and he broke it down into pages from the word go, and he thought it would make about 120 pages, and the scenes fitted very well. Because he was in Hay, and he was doing his thing, and I was in London. I don't know quite how he did all that, but it is remarkable. And then he would work in the early hours of the morning and send them off, so that I'd get up in the morning and find these images on my computer. It's wonderful.
That's fantastic. That's such a nice thing to wake up to. Inbox full of pictures. And so now the book is being released both in the UK and the US simultaneously, is that right?
I think so, yeah.
And will you be going on any sort of book tour?
Not to the US, unfortunately. Certainly, we opened in Hay at the festival, and we've got a couple of... events in London and Edinburgh Festival.
Do you feel that now that you've written it, would you still be interested in having it adapted as a film, or are you ready to move on to the next thing that you've got in the pipeline?
I'd be very happy for it to be adapted to a film, but also it's having seen Dix's images, I love the idea of that if it could be an animation. Mm. I mean, I think it would. I mean, it clearly, from my point of view, clearly lends itself to that. There's a Raymond Briggs's animation of his wonderful book about his parents, where I was the voice of his father, and so that was a revelation because the animators really captured his drawings perfectly, and the fact that you can do that.
It's so funny, I immediately thought of Raymond Briggs there, actually. I was kind of thinking, you know, it's like a deeply macabre snowman, but actually some of Raymond Briggs' work is hugely menacing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where the wind blows and things like that. It's kind of...
Yeah, and he's a great artist as well. I think there's a sensitivity and a wit there. And what I'm really proud of with the whole... procedure is that I spotted Dix as being a like-minded soul, and what a talent he is, and I thought it was hugely satisfying that when it came together, because we, as you were mentioning, you know, we do share a dark humour, I think.
Jim Broadbent there speaking to Augustin Macellari, and Dull Margaret is out this July. Catch Jim and the artist Dix in conversation at Gosh Comics in London on Tuesday, the 26th of June. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly.
From one Oscar winner to another now, when we last heard from Japanese composer Ryuichi Sakamoto, he was discussing his latest critically lauded electronic albums Async and Async Remodels. But the legendary composer of scores for film hits such as Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, and founding member of Japan's Yellow Magic Orchestra, never stops moving.
He's the subject of a new documentary about his life, Coda, directed by filmmaker Stephen Nomura Schibel. The film looks at Sakamoto's work in music over the past four decades, as well as his experiences surrounding events such as the Japanese tsunami of 2011 and his recent treatment of a life-threatening cancer.
Ryuichi and Stephen joined Monocle's Tom Hall to talk about the film earlier.
Any interest in showing my private life, but it was a very rare, important moment of Japanese society in 2012. It was a time the ordinary Japanese people went out onto the street to speak out mainly against nuclear energy, because we had serious nuclear plant accidents in Fukushima. So it was almost like the first time in 40 years regular Japanese people went out to speak out. So I thought it would be very nice to have a document of that through my eyes. That's what your intention, right?
Yes, sort of. Originally, so the project started in 2012, as Ryuichi had mentioned, and this was in the wake of Fukushima and the tsunami and the disaster. And it was literally a life-changing event for, I think, many of us who are from Japan. You know, I'm originally from Tokyo. I was born and raised there. Personally, I felt like my world was turned upside down. I still feel this way, that I can never really go back home again. Even when I go back to Japan or Tokyo, it's not the same place. It'll never be the same. And I, as a filmmaker, was just wondering, you know, well, what can I do? Maybe can I express something about that? And I happened to see Ryuichi at a grassroots event in 2012 related to the contamination issue. And I didn't realize at that time, I didn't know about his activism concerning the environment. And I said, my goodness, there is a story to be told, because I grew up in Tokyo during the 80s when he was, you know, a big, he still is a huge star, of course, but, you know, I mean, his music was everywhere, you know, on the streets of Tokyo when I was growing up. You know, people were dancing to YMO on the streets, you know, in Harajuku and everywhere. And I remember Ryuichi from my childhood as a person who represented the happiness, in a sense, that technology could bring. I don't think it was an intended image that you projected, you know, Ryuichi, but I think it's something that was a part of the media campaign for sure. And when I saw Ryuichi kind of, you know, as we all were, you know, so remorseful and concerned about what technology brought to our home country in some ways, I thought that this was, that there's a full circle here. There's a deep story. And at the same time, I felt, you know, since he's such an amazing artist, that something beautiful may come out of this in the end. So that was really the impetus, on my end at least.
Ryuichi, you say in the film that around that time, to not speak your mind would have been very stressful. But you also point out a little later in the film that your music has not been overtly political, sort of really ever, but maybe around this time you started to think differently about it. Did that occur in your mind as a conscious change?
Basically, there's no difference about my aspect about music. To me, music is not a vehicle to convey my political and social messages. Music stands by itself, by its own beauty and its own strength. I started worrying about lots of environmental issues in the early 90s, like 92. My youngest son was 1 year old at that time. So I imagined the environment or natural, or how can I say, environment 20 years after that, when my son gets like 20 years old. You know, I started seeing such a disastrous things would come. So that's why it's every adult's responsibility to do something for the future.
And Stephen, you were making this film with Ryuichi, as you've said, over a really long amount of time. I mean, over half a decade. What's the process for making a film like that? I mean, can you budget it in sort of traditional terms, or is it more about just signing on and being like, I'm going to be here until this is done, however it's done?
That's a very good question. I think there's always a duality involved in the filmmaking process. Of course, you have a budget, but if you're doing something meaningful, you're always not having enough money. If you're doing something that's extremely commercial, you have a problem. You have too much money and people are fighting over the politics oftentimes. So it's about a balance. But this one, it really started spontaneously. So like I said, I was at an event and I saw Ryuichi. And it was a very moving event, you know, about the contamination in Japan. It was like the beginning of a Hollywood movie. Basically, the message of this amazing scientist who does his work under very difficult conditions. Because if you're a nuclear physicist in Japan, even now, and if you have an anti-nuclear power stance, basically you're cut off from financing. So there's no censorship in Japan per se, but there is this kind of covert way of making life difficult for people who really care about this issue. So anyway, so when I saw Ryuichi there, the message was basically, if you have a child, try not to go back home. And I'm a father as well, and my child was 2 at that time. And it was very dramatic, you know. And then when I saw him, and I felt, my goodness, you know, I've done a music film before. I had the honor to work with Eric Clapton before on a project. And I said, I could maybe do something. I can maybe make something. Maybe I'll just send a proposal. And I didn't expect a response, to be honest, but I did, you know, get a response from Ryuichi. And because I knew that he's not really an exhibitionist. He's a very private person. He's very minimal, as you know, from all this body of work. I didn't think he would accept the idea of a documentary. But since he did, I very spontaneously put together a crew, flew to Japan. We started to kind of follow him during this summer in 2012 when we all thought, in retrospect, mistakenly, that something was going to change in Japan. I just dove in that sense. And then gradually during that first summer as we filmed, I also realized and started to think that just talking to Ryuichi about his politics really won't work. You know, of course, he took a very amazingly bold stance, and it was extremely meaningful in the context of the history of, you know, art in Japan, I think, that he took his stance. But I also felt that we needed to kind of tie it into his creative expression, that we needed to follow him until he found a new song or an album or something that really kind of integrated his concerns into the film and into his own work. And so then that became a very long process until Ryuichi kind of found his way to that place and we found a way to cover it.
我々日々暮らしていればこう音に囲まれているわけですけど Sound reflective. The world is full of sounds. We don't really hear them as music. But the sounds are actually very interesting musically. So I have a strong desire to incorporate them into my work.
I mean, you mentioned there that Ryuichi works in sort of well, not typical ways, definitely unusual, I would say, ways. Ryuichi, there's a really nice sort of synergy in the film about your method of working, which seems incredibly natural and not about sort of forcing things, but maybe working through processes. Mm-hmm. There's this great part in it where you're at the piano and you're talking about how pianos that are in tune are actually sort of out of tune with nature because they've been manipulated by man. Yes. And that, you know, a natural event and a disaster such as the tsunami is actually almost sort of nature. Your piano is no longer in tune anymore, but it's definitely in a more natural state. Is that something that you would like to elaborate on a bit?
That experience of touching and seeing that flooded piano by tsunami changed my aspect to the piano or to the music or maybe to more broadly to human civilization. In the beginning, when I got there, I visited that high school and looked at the piano. My impression was it was an undead piano. The piano was dead. But, you know, I've been thinking about that piano for a long time, you know, wouldn't go away from my mind. So I always thinking. Then changed my aspect of, wait, maybe it's not. Well, it's a dead piano as the piano which was the instrument human beings designed. But this is an assembly of the materials and then tuned by the tsunami, tuned by the force of nature. Those materials, like iron and wood and etc., would want to going back to where they were. Like without the force of tsunami, but just to leave a normal piano in your room for 2 years, 3 years, you get the out of tune. But out of tune as the aspect of human beings, but as materials of nature, you know, they are slowly going back to the original state. So that's my recent aspect.
And if we can talk about some of your work, I mean, some of it that is captured on film, working on records such as Async, and your headspace now, I mean, it seems like you're very keen to combine natural sound with synthesized sound and make it into something which is just one sound and people can't really tell the difference. Are you still working in that way? Because obviously that film would have been shot maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago. Are you still sort of reaching for that goal?
Yeah, not to combine or to mix natural sounds and the electronic sound to make into a piece of music, but I'm more interested in sounds of things, like normal things, or things including nature, like raindrops or the sound of a rock or whatever, waterfall, icebergs maybe, but also the sounds of artificial things like a glass here, mic, a chair, table, whatever. Because even those artificial things are designed by humans, but originally they're taken from the nature. It's more like I like to hear the sounds of materials of nature, whether it's designed or not. So maybe without my electric side, I don't really need, but I can design just the sounds of raindrops to make music.
And Stephen, I mean, you mentioned working with other musicians in the past, such as Eric Clapton, you know, far more conventional, let's say. You know, he works in such a unique and, you know, almost sort of natural and slow way. Did you learn anything about how to make films yourself from that?
Oh, yes, very much so. A very lucky person in that part of what I do for work is I get to observe very gifted creative people, and yet I get to create as I observe. So in a sense, the film is like my diary notes of learning from a master craftsman. Whenever I would approach him with a preconceived idea, very left brain thinking, if you will, I would say, Sakamoto-san, I want us to talk about this period in your life because I want the story to reflect this part of your history. I think basically your response would be, Stephen, why do you have a plan? How silly of you. You know, what's you know, a plan? You know, because Ryuichi is a firm believer in spontaneity and improvising. So eventually I learned to just lose that sort of thinking, because as we were editing and getting ready for the Venice Film Festival for a world premiere, we started to run out of time. And it was just like, forget about like what you think you want the movie to be. The best creative things that come out of any process are the things you just discover as they happen. When your left brain isn't bothering and kind of trapping your subconscious, and when you're just finding things out at the moment spontaneously, that's when the best things start to come out.
I'm really interested in the sort of tension between planning and spontaneity. Mm-hmm. Ryuichi, I mean, do you never plan, or do you have a broad kind of guide in your mind for, I mean, you obviously have goals and objectives. So is that something that you sort of have to stop yourself over planning, or is it just because you do not enjoy planning and it doesn't feel creative to you?
One thing is, you know, I've learned from my experiences. Like I have recorded other musicians for probably over 40 years in the studios in many different countries, many different cities. And then so I got conclusion, you know, always take one is the best. Always the first trial, first impression, first improvisation or first spontaneity is the best, and we have technology to fix it. Of course, there might be some, you know, wrong notes or out of tune. Out of tune is welcome, actually, now, I say. But, you know, if we need, you know, we have technology to fix it. So I probably, Walter Benjamin, the German philosopher, long time died during the, maybe before the World War II, said the very important word aura or aura. So the aura is the, I don't know, the most important thing of music or art or film also. And the practicing music gets aura away. So always the second take, third take, fourth take, you know, technically you get the very better results, but aura goes away easily. So the grabbing the moment of aura or aura is very important for me and for other musicians too.
The film, it covers some really difficult times in your life. I mean, you had health problems in the last few years, and you had to stop playing music for a while during that. How did you sort of navigate around that as a creative? Did you find other creative outlets to focus on, or was it more about the health goal and you were just absolutely set on achieving that and you didn't mind that the music was not in your life for a while?
I found if you're sick or if you are under tremendous stress, fear, for instance, after 9/11 terrorism, or when I had cancer, to me, I cannot think about music. I cannot even enjoy listening to music. So what I did was watching DVDs instead. Asian films,
yeah.
Chinese and Taiwanese, Hong Kongese movies, basically.
There's a part in the film where you're talking about during the 80s, I think working with Bertolucci, where you say that you wrote 45 songs in 1 week. Mm. Is that a regular work rate for you, or was that an absolute anomaly?
It was abnormal.
One thing that I thought was really interesting was when you were talking about when you first came into film scoring, Merry Christmas to Mr. Yeah. Lawrence, yeah. You were obviously initially offered a role in the film, yeah. and you say on the film, I should have just accepted that, but strangely, I demanded that I do the film score too.
That's right.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because that's the sort of mindset of maybe someone who doesn't feel entirely like they can impose their will on a project, but you tried it anyway and it worked. Mm. And then you have this situation with someone like Bertolucci where he's like, rewrite this now and you need to do it. But as you get older and through your career and you obviously grow far, far more confident in your ability and your status, would you still be open to someone coming in today at this stage of your career and being like, Ryuichi, this isn't good enough, rewrite it in half an hour?
I still get those words even now from even much younger film directors. Yeah. Like Inari too, or other film directors, they do. That's their job.
So you're always open to feedback like that?
I have to. because it's my decision to work with them, work on some interesting project, film project. So, yeah. And in a creative world, there's no age difference. You know, young or old, it doesn't matter.
And Stephen, what is it that you would like viewers to take the most from this film? Because it really gracefully combines quite a few very complex themes, really. I mean, Ryuichi's long, illustrious career and some of the hugely pressing world issues, as we've said. What would you like people to take from it the most?
That's a good question. I mean, it's really, you know, it's many things, this film. But it's about Mr. Sakamoto's music, of course. It's about his career, as you say. But I think it's also about the world. And it's really about the world we live in, seen, or more like heard through his ears. I wanted the film to reflect upon his awareness in some way, and it's a profoundly kind of broad awareness that we have. You know, even when you think about the different musical styles that Mr. Sakamoto has had throughout his career, it's quite extensive, and it's very uniquely, it has very many shapes and forms in theaters. I kind of envision the release as something like a listening party for an album that doesn't exist, you know, and that I want it to be a communal experience where people can come and really enjoy the sound and feel the music, so to speak.
Recently, more and more, I believe, listening is music, or listening is making music. And the influence of John Cage is getting heavier on me.
So silence is music too.
Yeah, but there's no perfect silence in this world. I mean, as far as on this planet, there's always sound. And sounds are definitely the material of music. So listening to the sounds of the material is music.
Ryuichi Sakamoto and Stephen Nomuro Shibble there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. Their film, Coda, is out this week from the 29th of June. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Well, there we had it. Movement, music, Margaret, a couple of Oscar winners too. You can't really ask for much more on a Sunday lunchtime, can you?
No, I'm certainly feeling culturally nourished, Marcus, for the next week or so and beyond, I think. Will you be participating in Art Night in a couple of weeks' time, you think?
Possibly, at least if you are coming with me.
Perhaps we could take a nice wander into the night, Marcus. Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, that's all for this edition, 468 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Limichi Okamoto. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. Special thanks also to Chiara Rimella. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now it's goodbye from me, Markus Hippi.
And from me, Daniel Bache. Thank you for listening and goodbye.